Someone asked me a question recently. Can the guru be a friend? Can I consider my guru as my friend? It's a very interesting question. Sounds very simple, but quite interesting when we explore it. So it depends on what my definition of friendship is. Now, in my case, I was 29, 30, my guru was 83, I didn't consider him a friend. He was more a fatherly or grandfatherly figure because the age gap was vast. Yet, when I sat with him, not in satsang, but when I would meet him for a cup of tea in the evenings, it was as if I was sitting with a friend. Now, what this means is when one feels as comfortable with a guru as one is with a friend, that quality of friendship prevails, especially when there is not much of an age gap. Now, in some guru-disciple relationships, that dynamic is not allowed. It is made very clear that this is the guru figure and the student is the student. So, as far as this teaching is concerned, it is not the labels, not the words, but the qualities which are looked at. Now, for example, the great sage Ramana Maharshi said, when he was asked, how do I know that a guru is a guru? He said, by the sense of respect and reverence you feel for him, and whether you feel he or she displays the quality of humility. Very simple pointers. Now, what does this mean, displaying the quality of humility? If I look at my own teacher, my spiritual guide, I saw that anyone who walked in through the door was totally accepted for the way they are. Nobody was judged. I saw that when it came to satsang, celebrities from the West, renowned names, had to be just one of the people there, wherever they sat, maybe on the floor if they didn't get place, maybe on a chair. So to me, these became pointers of attributes of a guru. And of course, the ultimate criteria was the degree of peace that you feel in their presence. Once again, that is what Ramana Maharshi said. The degree of peace, not the degree of joy, not the degree of bliss, not being impressed by their aura and personality and the clothes they wear, but the degree of peace. Now, I consider myself blessed in three ways. I was not consciously on the spiritual path as such in my early days. I was suffering through challenges of the teenage years and thereafter. The burden of life was too heavy on me, because I had lost my father at the age of 14. And I will never forget when I was at his funeral and some people had come to pay their respects. One lady came up to me and said, "Be brave, you are the man of the house now." And I broke down. And I said, a 14-year-old boy is being told to be brave, you are the man of the house, when I'm the youngest of my siblings. And I asked myself, is this what life has in store for me? So mine was a typical journey of anyone who in their younger years has lost a parent. The fear of death loomed large because my 14-year-old brain reached the conclusion that if my father could die, then anyone in my life can die, including myself. So my life's experience was such that death became something I feared the most, and life became a burden. So those were years of struggle for me. And then when I was about 21 and I graduated, I started going to the office which my father had started, and my mother was going and sitting in his chair, trying her best to run the show, although she had no qualifications. She was a housewife. She came from Mussoorie. But as she said to me much later, The first day when my father's friends told her, look, Santosh, you have to go and sit in the office and try your best. That's all you can do. She said that first day in the morning, she used to pray to Shiva. She told Shiva, I will sit in the chair, but the rest you have to do. I can't do it. I am a mother of three. I am a housewife. I can't do it. And by the time I was 24, which is basically 3 years of experience at work, learning the ropes, so to speak. At that time, it was an ad agency. One fine day, the management decided to exit the agency and start their own agency overnight. Of course, they had planned it for a while. So this was what I was faced with at the age of 24. A staff of 35 people who were soon going to be abandoned. And so what my mother did, because she would not deal with clients, she didn't have the experience for that. She was just signing checks, seeing that payouts were made, monies were received. She approached our auditor and said, what do we do now? Do we hire a professional? We tried it. In 2 months, he left. What do we do now? She asked him. Should we close it down? And he gave sage advice. He told her, look, let's be objective and understand the situation. When your husband died, it could have closed down then. It didn't. Life and the flow of life took it till this point. No matter that the agency has incurred losses, debts, it is still afloat as of now. He said, there is only one option. Why not make your son sit in the chair? And she said, but out of a staff of 35, who will listen to him? He is the youngest. Would a staff older than the head listen to the head? And my nature was not that of a leader, not that of a CEO. I was quiet, gentle, and timid by nature. So I again felt life had been unfair to me, you see? So this is how life shaped me for things to come. Now, one thing I did know, because I was not the typical aggressive alpha male, by and large, everyone got along with me because I was never a problem for anyone. I'd like to disappear into the background. Now the challenge came that I had to meet clients which were big corporates. And the fear was that 90% of our clients would move to the new agency started by the management because they held all the relationships. So we were at ground zero. You know, Vimalananda said that the Aghori does his sadhana in the cremation grounds. Why? Because there's nothing lower than the cremation ground. That is ground zero. We were at ground zero. And the first meeting I went to, when I entered the cabin of the managing director, my legs started shaking because he had a conference table which could seat 16 people. Thankfully, there was no one there except he was right at the end. So there was me on the corner and he on the corner. And the meeting began. That was my first meeting. And he said to me, he said, I realize there's a change in management. And he was very okay about it. The meeting wrapped up. I did what I could. I was at the door and he looked back. He called out my name. He said, look, I am concerned with the service that I am given. If I am happy with the service, I have no reason to leave. And that gave me so much confidence. And by the hand of God, only 10% of the clients left and the 90% stayed. I am giving you this story. It might be a bit boring, but I would like to today speak about my journey to honor Guru Purnima, which is coming up in a few days, and the grace of the Guru coming back to the friendship. So from the age of 24, by and by, I was flowing with life. That is what was happening. A good 5 years passed. The agency was running quite well. I was 29. And at the age of 29, I decided to visit my sister in Hong Kong. She was living there at that time. It was November 1999. And at that time, she started speaking about a man she had met whom she was very impressed with. He had written a book called The Power of Now. Just maybe it was released in the US just a few months earlier. And it so happened that a friend of hers from Hong Kong was visiting Vancouver on work, went to a bookstore. He had spiritual interests. The bookstore owner said that there's someone in our own city who has written this book. You might enjoy reading it. And so he got the book and read it overnight in the hotel room. And he went back to the bookstore and said, "Can I meet this man?" And they said, "You can try. This is the phone number." And they met. So then my sister's friend was so impressed with the book and the man that he invited Eckhart to Hong Kong to stay with him. Now, this happened at the time I was visiting Hong Kong on holiday. And my sister said, "Look, Eckhart is here. We are with him. And what we have done is a few people, 10, 15 people, have read the book and they would like to meet him. So we are doing these one-hour sessions, one-on-one. So would you like to meet him?" And I said, "Certainly not." I said, "I'm on holiday. I'm really enjoying myself, loving it. Going to cafes, shops, the bars and restaurants at night. And I said, I'm on holiday. This does not sound like part of a holiday plan to me." But she insisted. You see, this is where grace comes in. We think one thing, but something else happens. And so I put on a bit of a sulky face and I went there in the morning to meet Eckhart. Till this point, I had no interest in spiritual teachers or spiritual teachings because my life's experience had consumed me. And my own life was teaching me how transient life's experience was, how unreliable, how fraught with negativity. So I was happy with my experience. So I went into that meeting and it was a very huge living room, very Zen-like interiors, beautiful, like a spa. And Eckhart was sitting on the sofa and I walked in and the door was closed. My one-to-one session had begun. And so my first thing was to apologize to him. I said, "Look, I have not read your book. And my sister said I can ask you any questions I like about my life. And I have not made a list of questions. So what do we do?" He said, "What would you like to talk about? Let's forget all this." I said, "I'd like to talk about my holiday in Hong Kong." He said, "All right, what have you observed?" And I was observant as a child. So I said, "Firstly," I said, "Eckhart, everyone I have seen, 90% of the people you see on the streets at that time, they wore black. Black shirt and blue jeans or black jeans and some other color." I said, "That's my observation. That is why I am wearing all black. My first meeting, I was wearing black trousers and a black shirt and a black jacket. There's a photo of that also." He said, "You're very observant because even I've noticed it." I said, "Second point, there are banks all over. You look north, south, east, west, northeast, northwest, southeast, southwest, you will see a bank. And fair enough, outside the window, you could see all the neon signs of the banks because it was an apartment very high up." And he just nodded his head and he said, "Lots of money energy is here." So I said, this is how my conversation of Vana began. And I did think that Eckhart must have found me quite arrogant because others must have come with a genuine spiritual concern to him. So these were my feelings that what must he be thinking that I'm a waste of time. So this 1 hour transpired. I felt nothing happened and I left. And my sister later asked me and her friends were very keen to know how did the 1 hour go. And I said, we enjoyed ourselves. We talked shop and I'm sure nobody else could talk to Eckhart about banks and shops and all that. And they just said, okay. I said, but one thing I must tell you. I said, I have never been listened to so totally. Nobody has heard me like this man heard me. He didn't change the topic. He didn't intervene any time when I spoke. His eyes didn't look left, right, or at the clock. And I said, I felt, what's wrong with this man? It's as if I'm chanting mantras and he's looking at me with such reverence. That feeling really haunted me for my entire trip. And when I kept going back to the memory while I was in Hong Kong of that 1 hour, because it kept coming back to me, the only word which described it was silence. I could feel that the room was vibrating with silence. It was like a vacuum. It was maybe 20 years later that I felt a transmission had taken place at that time. Not that I was special, then I received a special transmission. But for my psyche, my being, received something which no words can describe. That was in November 99. Now, in Feb 2000, because that for me was my pivotal moment in life, three things had happened. One is my mother had her own spiritual awakening in 1995, and her diary of experiences ended in 1999, with the last experience being the spiritual heart and the death. And 99, I met Eckhart. Now, the same group which hosted Eckhart came in Feb 2000 for the launch of my mother's first book, because they were close friends of my sister. And what happened? They said, you know, since we've come for the book launch, we've also heard of this master called Ramesh Balsekar, so we are going for his satsang since we are here. Why don't you come along? I said, certainly not. Sunday morning, I said, Saturday night, we are out with friends, late night, doesn't interest me. Same thing. So, unfortunately, I had to drop them from the Oberoi to the house. My sister said, at least that much, please do for my friends. So we dropped them and I came back. And after the satsang, they came back here and they said, look, we have come from Hong Kong because our interests are spiritual. We want to know what life is about. This gentleman is in your same city. So why don't you give it a chance? So I said, we'll see. And they went every day because he was retired. He gave satsangs every day. And after the book launch and all, they went back. So again, my sister Nikki, she said, look, let's go. And she dragged me there. And when I went there, it was not love at first sight. I was quite bored and amused. I didn't feel reverence. I didn't see a bolt of lightning strike me. None of that. I was bored because I thought that this elderly man is only saying whatever happens is the will of God and this too shall pass. And I said, what is there to tell people this? Don't they know it? My life's experience has been that my will is irrelevant. If God could take away my father at the age of 14, I had no role to play in it. Yet it was the biggest event in my life. So do people need to be told that everything is the will of God? Isn't it obvious? Do people need to be told everything is transient? Isn't it their life's experience? Do people need to be told this too shall pass? Don't they know that? So my mind was quite rejecting this fact, not the teaching, but the fact that people were coming to hear the most basic message, which is their own life's experience. What is their need to come for that? Now, the amusing part, which is very important, is his satsang comprised half foreigners, half Indians. At the end of the satsang, they gave out these booklets, which were Marathi abhangas, which people would sing. And what was amusing was foreigners singing it. That I was really entertained by. To watch foreigners singing in Marathi and reading out and trying their best, but they were so lost in it. It was so beautiful to see that. So then when my sister went back to Hong Kong, next Sunday, I found myself driving back to see the foreigners sing the abhangs. really, I'm not making any of this up. And the minute I sat there in the satsang and it began, I said, again ye bol raha hai, everything is God's will, nobody does anything. It was the same thing. So my journey was such that my unconscious life experience had prepared me. Grace had got me to the doorstep of the wisdom teachings without my involvement. The message of peace pulled me, not through my conscious mind, because my conscious mind was resisting all this, through my subconscious, my life's experiences, pulled me to its doorstep. Everything else is secondary, views, opinions, judgments, immaterial. And so I realized, whether it was Eckhart, whether it was Ramesh Balsekar or my mother, I was introduced to peace. All were living embodiments of peace. And therefore, I realized over the years when I visited Eckhart, when I went to satsang at Rameshji's home and living with my own mother, the greatest quality of peace is that peace draws peace to itself. Peace draws peace to itself. So what is happening in a gathering like this? It may appear you have heard something, someone has told you something, you have watched something. That is all on the manifest plane, which is just the tip of the iceberg. But there is a voice within this call for peace, and it is pulling to itself. Whatever my life circumstances, whatever the ups and downs, whatever the highs and lows, whatever the suffering, this is an ancient voice. This is the voice of the Guru. This Guru is not a person. Guru is consciousness. Guru is the Guru principle. Guru is the quality of silence and peace. Is pulling. It is like consciousness has thrown a lasso around people's heads and is pulling them towards itself. Those people who have some setbacks or the other in life, and I've really wondered, is life really about all this? Or is there a deeper meaning to life? What is life about? Am I going to face challenges all my life? And if so, how do I deal with them? Such people in whom this inquiry has started by the same grace are drawn to talks like this. You see, because we can live the rest of our lives till our last breath in ignorance and suffering, repeating pattern after pattern after pattern, and having a split view of life and the people in our lives into those we love and those we hate. And we die because we got lost in the realm of separation. We got split between those who gave us a lot of money and those who took away our money. We got lost in the realm of separation. But when consciousness shines this divine light that I am the one behind it all, look at me. Don't look at personality, whether it is others or your own. Look at the I am. One source, one consciousness, one singularity operating in duality. Realize that some instruments in life are bound to cause you pain, other instruments in life will cause you joy. Yet, they are all instruments through whom the same consciousness functions. And what comes unasked in life is the flow of life, pleasure or pain, is what you are meant to face, not meant to run away from. And that is why the Buddha said, samsara is dukkha, nirvana is shanti, and they are not two. Samsara, the cycle of birth and death, this wheel of time, is dukkha. Maybe when you're young, you don't realize it. You think it's all about pleasure and pleasure and pleasure. But eventually you realize that that pleasure brings you suffering. Nirvana is shanti, peace. And they are not two. Which means that peace has to be found through the suffering. Not by turning away from it. Not by blaming God for it.
not by blaming others for it, by what life presents to me in front of me, to come to terms with this, to come to terms with the fact that in deep sleep I am most peaceful. Everyone loves deep sleep. Nobody wants a disturbed sleep. Nobody complains that they slept well, which basically means that the absence of me and my story is the presence of deep peace. Now, can this peace be found in the waking state? That is what the spiritual journey is about. You see, so these teachings are what is referred to as living teachings. They may not teach you about particular verses and chapters of the Gita, particular scriptures, reading paragraphs of books and trying to understand them. That is one way of learning. This is going to one's direct life experience, because that is the only experience you have, that you've lived so many years. That is your experience, that is your experience, that is your experience. So it addresses the experience of life. It does not add gyan and knowledge in terms of theories. But when this understanding happens, then that theory makes more sense. When I can understand that in my own life, everyone is an instrument through whom God's will operates, I can understand when Lord Krishna tells Arjuna that you are only the instrument and you're trying to teach me lessons in morality by telling me that you can't kill your preceptors. First of all, you've taken me as your guru in the battlefield and now you're giving me gyan. So when it becomes one's life's experience and one has the humility to accept that the person I hated and blamed and condemned for being nasty to me was simply playing out their script based on their conditioning and nature, just as I was playing out my script. Only in this case, it was my destiny to be hurt. So hurt happened. Then this understanding brings peace with it. That is what happened. So everything in my life going forward recalibrates itself towards peace, which basically is the death of the thinking mind, which is too focused on others and on the past and on the future. When you're 10 years old, you don't even know these concepts of past and future. When you enter your teen years, you feel life, a great stretch of life is ahead of you. So there's a lot of future to look forward to and little past. Very few regrets and disappointments, but the whole future is ahead. And then you enter your late 20s and there's a bit more past, more regrets, more disappointments, little lesser future, but still there's ample future not to worry about. And then you reach midlife, half. Now you're a bit like, what happens? Too many regrets, too many disappointments, too many complaints, too many people I don't like. And I hope the rest of my life doesn't go like that. But when the inquiry, when the spiritual dimension is not explored, I'm 55, 60. Now there's a big load, but I still feel there's a future. I'm still only 60. That is why my teacher in my second book, The Buddha Sword, in his foreword wrote that once he met a doctor in a hospital and the doctor asked him, what do you do? And he said, I give talks on Advaita Vedanta. And he said, oh, I will get into that only when I'm very old. Now I'm not old enough. Someone in his late 50s, the doctor. So you see, this march of life is unconscious. We start living from the past because we are conditioned beings. We judge the present and the future based on past conditioning. A motherload of past conditioning of what people did to me, said to me, and so on and so forth. So we are replaying out our past only. So your future is your past, isn't it? Because your eyes are conditioned. Your future is your past. So then at the end of your life, supposing you know you're going on the last day, you tell yourself, I really lived a wonderful past life. Because all my life I was living in the past. It is true. Or Grace steps in and says, perhaps it's time to drop it. Perhaps the time has come. See people with fresh eyes. The same people in your life. Is there a new way of seeing them. There is not seeing with the eyes of duality, but the eye of singularity, the single eye, the third eye, the eye of Shiva. Then the possibility is I'm out of this game. I still have to function within it. That is predetermined. The matrix of duality is set, but in full awareness, I find it does not disturb me like it used to. That, to me, is the guru. Out of the cycle of birth and death, when we die to our past convictions, when we die to our past judgments, when we die to condemnation, to ill will, to spite, to jealousy, to envy, to guilt, and to shame, it's finished. So, the guru is teaching us about death. Not death of the body, death of the ego, the thinking mind of the ego, which is standing on the pedestal of separation. Because you will agree that in deep sleep, you're not afraid to die. If you're in deep sleep and I come to your house tonight and I whisper in your ears, you're going to die, would you react? You're in deep sleep. You're still alive. So who is it that fears death? The ego. The sense of identification with name and form is afraid to die. And what the guru does, being compassionate and sensitive, is makes the ego die little by little, bit by bit. And then when that ego is freed of all this burden of doership, that ego starts living life more fully. So people have this conventional idea of a guru. Because we are in the world of form, so we take that the guru is limited to the form. The form is just the aspect of form of the formless. What a joyful journey it is. The spiritual journey is truly, it should make one happy to be on a spiritual journey. If someone is following a guru or a technique or a kriya and is feeling sad about it, I would say, please leave. There's enough sadness in life. You don't need more of it. Be happy to investigate, inquire, find out, because you're discovering your true nature and everyone's true nature. That brings joy. It should be uplifting. It should not be a punishment. When the Sufi mystic Bhai Sahib said that we should pray to God for the love of the Guru and pray to the Guru for the love of God, what did he mean? He didn't mean pray to God to love an individual as a Guru and to get that individual's love. Pray to God for the love of the Guru consciousness, the Guru principle, and pray to the Guru, which is the manifest form, for the love of God. So what happens? If a Guru is telling people, see God above everyone, he is inculcating love of God in you. The Guru is not saying love everyone as an individual. It is impossible. How can you love everyone in your life? There are people who've really been mean to you. But when the Guru says, see the hand of God above all, there's a total acceptance of the other being an instrument of God. So my focus has already shifted to God. That is what happens. And that is why when he says, the night can last an entire life without the Guru, what night is he referring to? You may say, I have a pretty good life. I have not suffered major issues, major setbacks. So this statement is irrelevant. He is referring to the night of the illusion of separation. It can last an entire life without consciousness, lost in the world of form, and counting how many pleasures have come to me and how many pains have come to me, and making like a trial balance to figure out, was my life okay? When we can wish well to even those who have harmed us, then we know a transformation has happened. We may not want to deal with them. We may prefer to stay away. But deep in our hearts, when we realize, may you get strength to deal with the challenges which come your way, then you know an inner transformation has happened. Or you may say, may nobody else be troubled by you as you have troubled me. You see, these are all spontaneous prayers of compassion for other people, because everyone is carrying their cross. We don't know what it is. We judge by what we see. We don't know everyone's background. We don't know everyone's past. We don't know everyone's conditioning, how they were treated as children. But we are judging by what appears in front of us in this moment. How is it possible to judge this person? That is a grave injustice. I used to think everyone's mother was like my mother. Every child will initially not have the realization that people are different when they are young. My mother never reacted, ever. So I thought everyone's mother never reacted. So you see, conditioning is so crucial because it is imbibed by children from their parents, the parents from their parents. I kind of assumed that the default setting was one of peace and harmony, which clearly it isn't by and by in life. But I am extremely humbled that I received this conditioning. I remember in the early days, one morning I woke up with this whole thing buzzing in my head. Everything is God's will. Everyone is the instrument of God and all that. And I forget whether it was Shiva or Vishnu. I suddenly, it was like a snapshot that everyone in my life was the form of Vishnu. The client who wasn't paying me on time. My driver. The building lift man who was doing like this, with the building, the lift gates at that time. And I thought, whom are we getting upset about? And whom are we loving? That is the Maya. And the other thought was that every view, every opinion, every judgment, every condemnation is all going on in my own consciousness only. So whom am I fooling? All of you appearing within my own consciousness, not apart from it. So can I be closer to you than you? Isn't it absurd? Can you be closer to your loved one than the one you hate if both are appearing in your consciousness? In deep sleep, whom are you closer to? The one you love or the one you hate? Both disappear. So in the waking state, these are just aspects of consciousness which have been labeled. It is popping into your consciousness. Consciousness is one. And what has happened is within that consciousness, I have like a nice big cake and I cut small pieces for everyone. I have created these parent, child, friend, lover, colleague, people I love less, people I love least, people I hate. One consciousness has been nicely sliced up and cut and small, small pieces have been made. Cake is one, ingredients are one, but I like these pieces, these I won't have. Does that make sense? If you saw a nice big cake, Lotus Biscoff, it's all the same. Whether you get a slice from the left or the right does not matter. Then your mantras start becoming in life. Whatever you face, it is what it is. What can I do about it? Or so be it. Your point of view is different from mine, so be it. You are equally entitled. So simple life becomes. And life will keep teaching us lessons till the lessons are learned. That's why some of us wonder how the same lesson keeps coming back in front of us all the time. That is the design of life. Would anyone like to share anything or ask anything? Let's pass that term.
In my sunset years, I become peaceful effortlessly because in retrospection, I feel I've exhausted heavy karmic load. 30 years, everything became cakewalk. I accidentally lost one eye after I lost my son. Everybody was crying. I said, I still have one eye,
exactly.
Which is very good.
Exactly.
It is because, and maybe when you were going through it, it was difficult. I've exhausted it, learned the lesson, come to the end of the life. Quality is my focus. My health is good. I lead a very rich, meaningful life. And I was a person full of passion, desire. My passion became love. Love became divine. I feel passion also plays a role.
Of course. And one should be passionate about peace. It's so true that gratitude for that one eye, the gratitude for the one eye
because of my intense karma earlier. Suppose everything had been all right in my life, I would have been crying.
Yes, correct.
Relative. So everything faded in comparison to my early karmic load.
That is why, you know, I feel, honestly, it is better to have an early karmic load than a later karmic load. Because then you can't handle the later karmic load. You see? That is why Ramana Maharshi again was so right when he said that it is the early blows in life which make you come on to the spiritual journey. See, what has to be faced has to be faced. But the advantage of early blows is you wake up faster. Otherwise, you live your life, the living dream of life, and then you have a very short time to wake up if you have blows later.
Also, pain is a purifying process. You have to make a choice to be better or bitter. Bitter is effortless. Better, you have to put, and also the divine grace.
Bitter, being bitter is effortless because it's so easy to be bitter. Bitter about life, bitter about people. Except you should not be bitter about bitter chocolate, because I like that. See, some people come with a very heavy karmic load. You see a lot of suffering in their lives. Some people have a relatively light karmic load. It is not for us to question this. Why me? Because that is the poor me syndrome. You see, because someone asked this question to my teacher and he gave what would be considered to be a very cold answer. At that time, this person came to satsang and said, this is what has happened, these are the losses I have faced, all this has gone wrong. So much for one person. Why me? And I still remember Rameshji was already probably in his late 80s then. There was silence, the room was silent, there was a big pause, he did not reply immediately. And then he leaned forward like this and told the person, why not? How do we know a load is a load? We are too puny, our intellect is too puny to understand the why me. The rivers of karma run deep. We are trying to look for cause-effect relationships. I was a good person. I didn't do bad to anyone. Why did this happen to me? How can this puny intellect, which is just trying to find cause-effect relationships, understand the cosmic law? So this why me, the poor me, me and my story, that is the cause of the suffering. That is perpetuating the identity. Me, 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 me. That is why Maharaj, when he was pushed for a practice, though he didn't like to give any, he said, when you see something in life or hear something, change your internal dialogue from I see something to something is seen. I hear something to something is heard. Remove the me. Because if the me is removed in that sense and someone says something and the me is removed, would you object? Can a blank slate object to what is being said? So someone is taking delivery of what is being said, taking it personally and reacting. That is the me. You said this to me. Now, we have to function as the ego. We are shaped by our conditioning. We are going to react. But with the understanding, what we find is what was earlier knee-jerk reactions, always pushing back about to people who pushed our buttons, unconsciously reacting, you said this to me, so I said this to you. That reaction starts turning into a response. Just because you said something to me, I don't need to give you back because that's not my nature. So that possibility arises. So I find that I'm less reactive and more responsive. I find that I rest more and more in shanti, in peace. That person becomes a blessing wherever they go. You know, you could be in a restaurant and you will have no idea what a benediction the person who is at peace has given to those in the restaurant when he or she is there. And it can happen the other way also. I have this distinct memory when I went with Eckhart to a restaurant.
in Vancouver, on the next table, as soon as we sat down, one man started becoming very agitated without a cause. And what Eckhart said to us was, pain body has got activated. If those who are few who are familiar with his work will be familiar with the term pain body, because the pain body cannot bear presence. It will put up a fight. That is what can happen at an energetic level. I don't even have to speak to someone. So imagine the gift when you are at peace, wherever you go, you're like a flower. And imagine if inside you have a toxic mind, wherever you go, you are spreading the vibration of toxicity. The only thing is we can't see it because our eyes are limited. But this is a vibratory field. We all vibrations. This table is a denser vibration than this body, so it looks denser. People used to laugh at Hindus, especially when they would worship machines and inanimate objects. How foolish are they? It is consciousness being worshipped. Ancient rituals and practices come from a deep place of wisdom, not to be laughed at. People used to laugh at the Native American Indian chiefs because they would wear headgear with feathers. Those feathers are actually streams of light of the Sahasrar Chakra in a symbolic form, because the head was supposed to be enlightened. From the Sahasra Padma, he was operating, tapping into the cosmic consciousness. So for the ordinary person who can't see that, it became a head of feathers. So what was glorified was unity consciousness, being at peace. Kings were given crowns because of the crown chakra. That is why they were appointed as king of ancient times, not the bloodlines we see today. Everything comes from somewhere. The church bell or the temple bell which you ring, Sahasrar chakra. So peace gets overlooked because it cannot be seen, heard, tasted, smelt, and touched. You will agree, between you and me, there's space. There's much more space between you and me than you and me. That is peace. Emptiness, you could call it. Quietness, silence. The cinema screen is peaceful. The drama happens on the screen. Taken for granted. Space taken for granted, silence taken for granted, peace taken for granted. Which is more important? So rather than worship objects in consciousness, why not worship consciousness itself? When you are no longer obsessing with people, you are worshipping consciousness. One becomes so sensitive that you will think twice also before you say something to someone, because you don't want to take away their peace. That is the degree of sensitivity which comes up. Because to take away their peace is to take away your peace, because there is only one consciousness. Question is the content of that consciousness. Is it of peace or is it of conflict? Mine, yours is irrelevant. And when we accept nobody is the doer of their actions, it is actually the end of karma, because we are no longer perpetuating the cycle of karma. What a huge gift that one statement is, whether it is in the Gita or whether it is the Buddha. There is no individual doer of any deed. So can the guru be a friend? Yes, because you feel you can share anything with your friend. That must be the relationship with the guru. Why? Because the guru is not going to judge you. But can the guru only be a friend? No, because respect, reverence, looking up to. You may not feel these qualities in a friend. What is the job of the guru? You could say to enlighten me. What does to enlighten me mean? It's quite simple. When I know something now, which I didn't know earlier, I'm enlightened about it. This is how my mother explains it to her students. Because there are these huge concepts about enlightenment and some end goal to be reached. It is very simple. I didn't know this earlier. Now I know it. So I'm enlightened about something on which light was shown. That is all. The remover of ignorance is the other definition of guru. So I was ignorant about this dimension of life, which the Guru has now shown me. So remover of ignorance. Very simple, not big, big words. One has to keep it simple. We are not interested in these big terms. We have to walk where our feet are. As Shirdi Sai Baba says, everyone you meet in life is on account of Rinanubandhan. Be aware of that. And how do I meet those everyone? With an enlightened perspective rather than an ignorant one. That is it.